I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Affordable housing, tax incentives, and employee compensation are all issues trending throughout the metro area. Today, we sit down with council members from Lee Summit and Olathe to find out how their communities are addressing those issues and to ask how current events in Kansas City affect their work as municipal lawmakers. Then, people who once depended solely on guardianships to make life decisions could be able to gain more independence. We'll hear about strategies for giving the developmentally disabled more authority over their lives. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Look over the big issues facing some of the cities around Kansas City, and you can't help but notice a trend. They're facing some of the same issues. How much in tax incentives should these cities offer to businesses? Affordable housing, land use policies, how much in raises to give to employees? Now we'll meet city council members from Lee Summit and Olathe, and what is the first of what will be an ongoing series of conversations with representatives from cities outside of Kansas City. So let's get started. This is like old home week here, because joining us now are two city council members who once served in their state legislatures where I once covered them. Bob Johnson is a Lee Summit councilman and a former school board member and a Missouri state senator and representative. Bob, great to see you again. Welcome back.
Thank you, Steve.
Karen Brownlee is an Olathe at-large councilwoman who once served in the state Senate in Topeka, where she also worked as Secretary of Labor in the Brownback administration. Karen, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Good to see you, Steve.
Bob Johnson, let's start with you. You know, one of your big issues in Lee Summit is tax incentives for businesses and the degree to which developers are asking for TIFs and CIDs and the like. How big an issue is this for you guys out in Lee Summit?
It seems that, first of all, there are other – every issue that the state allows, every incentive, that we have some developer that wants to use it. You know, with development going the way it is, the economy's been strong over the last few years. We have a lot of these projects. It's almost like every meeting, we meet three evenings a month in a formal council session, and there's always something on our table. So, but and most developers want some type of an incentive.
Are you having the same debate in Lee Summit that Kansas City's been going through when it comes to, are we giving away the store, giving away too much here?
Yes, it is. And what's interesting is that, you know, I have residents, I have constituents who are following activities in Kansas City in terms of should there be a vote on an issue to limit incentives. And so I'm actually getting constituents who say maybe we should look at that in Lee Summit. And I would like to do that, mm-hmm. by the way.
Karen, how about you out in Olathe? What are you seeing?
Well, we have situations like the Great Mall of the Great Plain, which is being redeveloped. And so the developer on that development would like a number of incentives. And I think there were four different incentives all stacked together that have been offered for that. And certainly we want to redevelop that property. But we do hear back from the citizens. And even on one that's a CID on a different property, and that raises the sales tax, and that's generating some response from citizens.
You turned out to be the lone dissenting vote on that package of incentives for the Great Mall out there. Why did you go that way?
Because I was hearing from citizens, it just felt like it's becoming too much. Yeah. Certainly, we want quality development, but can we do it without offering star bonds, TIF, CID, IRBs, so on and so forth?
The economy's going great. Unemployment is low, and you begin to wonder, I guess, from your vantage point, how much incentive is really needed here.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Would the property redevelop anyway, or would it redevelop with maybe one or two of those incentives? And you might recall that the first year that I was in the Senate, I offered the incentives for the racetrack, mm-hmm. in Wyandotte County. So I started the Star Bonds and chaired Commerce Committee, did a number of incentives. But that area just keeps growing with more and more offerings.
Right. You know, Bob, I'm just wondering, just in general, maybe stepping back here from for a moment from these tax incentives, to what extent does the discussion at the Kansas City Council level sort of trickle down to the issues that you guys wind up debating in Lee Summit?
You know, I'm not sure there's a trickle down because Lee Summit's large enough that
sure.
we actually will have developers that might be considering both Kansas City and Lee Summit, and so... truly, we have a project before us now that has it literally is using every incentive the state's offered, plus a new one that they've created just for Lee Summit. So it just assumes that if it's a development issue, wherever else they're looking, what other cities are doing, that's what's going to be requested in Lee Summit. So we're not truly having to follow what's happening next door to us.
You know, why is this such a tough, going back to tax incentives, why is this such a tough issue for cities and state governments, Bob? Why don't cities and states, which are so cash-strapped these days, at least that's what you read, band together and say no more to anybody ever?
And that's one of the issues.
Put everybody in the same playing field.
Oh, sure. And the other issue is it's national in scope also. If they don't consider the state of Missouri, they go to Kansas and vice versa. But certainly we have to get our region together, and that's I don't know of an activity that's been started yet to initiate that. That would be great to do because we get
a metro-wide conversation.
Oh, certainly,
you're talking
because
about.
We've certainly had people say, you know, we're looking at Kansas, we're looking at other cities in Jackson County. I don't tend to believe them necessarily, but we ought to be on. We need to have some agreement with the local communities in the area.
Yeah, Karen Brownlee, Kansas City would certainly argue, at least some interest, that you know building downtown's a more expensive proposition than building out on the plains of Olathe, for instance. But do you think a metro-wide conversation's in order here?
Well, and I think that has been occurring because we have those conversations that why offer an incentive that just pulls one business after another only across the state line. Does that really add to the economy of the whole area? Not really.
Has that border war debate been settled in your mind?
Not really.
I'm not sure it has been either.
Right. And of course, I'm going to advocate for the Kansas side, and I would assume Bob's going to advocate for the Missouri side. And that's the role that we're in. But still, we can have that conversation to figure out what's the best use of these dollars.
Yeah. To what extent does Olathe compete with Kansas City when it comes to some of these projects? Are you aware of a tug-of-war between the two cities?
I am not aware of a specific business, for example, that's looking at downtown versus Olathe. I think typically, especially with the efforts of KCADC, the Area Development Council, you know, they are working with those coming from the outside to this area and trying to help them locate in the best place possible.
So they sort of mitigate those tensions in some cases.
I think so.
Yeah. Do you notice the same thing, Bob? Yeah.
I think they attempt to do that, yes.
Yeah. Let's go to one of your big issues, Karen. It's related to this. And again, that's the redevelopment of the Great Mall of the Great Plains. I just want to talk about it a minute more. This was a developer's request for about $70 million in Kansas tax incentives to build a hockey arena and a mixed-use development at the former mall site. Again, you were the only council member to vote no. How tough are these decisions for you and for anybody else on your council when these things come up?
Well, they are tough decisions because I want to listen to the citizens. I want to work with my colleagues, and I want to redevelop that property.
Mm-hmm.
So those being the goals, I want to move those things forward. But I also know there's a hockey arena on the Missouri side within close distance.
And Overland Park wants one.
Exactly. So I don't think three hockey arenas within, 30 miles or so are going to be supported. Maybe I'm wrong on that. Maybe that's the up-and-coming sport, but mm-hmm. I don't think we can support three.
You know, Bob Johnson and Lee Summit, another big concern for you is affordable housing. That also rings a big bell with what Kansas City is up against these days. What are you thinking about there? What's the issue in Lee Summit?
Well, the primary issue in Lee Summit is that in terms of full housing choice, and if you really support housing choice, that means people should have an opportunity to consider new housing. Pretty much in Lee Summit, you cannot find a new house that's less than $325,000, and probably we're beyond that today. Now, in case you haven't figured that out, that takes an income to make a monthly mortgage payment on that. So there's a huge portion of our our population that is in Lee Summit, coming to Lee Summit, that really cannot afford new housing, or at least the alternative.
So affordable housing is a big issue.
And affordable housing, and this is what's interesting, it is certainly, and what's interesting for me is I'm just trying to get housing prices that are down to $225,000. So we're not talking about $150,000 or $180,000 or whatever, and I'm not talking any subsidies, by the way. This is free market, but I'm just trying to deal with our land requirements and what the city requires for developments to get the cost of developing a piece of ground into developable lots.
So what are you doing to ensure that that happens?
What I have proposed an issue back in September, and it's, my colleagues are encouraging me, but we haven't really done with much with it. But there is a project on our agenda tomorrow night at City Hall. They're using existing code requirements that we have, zoning requirements, to get down to 38-foot front lots. Right now, pretty much single-family housing in Lee Summit, for the most part, without doing special modifications, is 70-foot fronts.
And that means bigger houses that cost more money.
Well, certainly, first of all, because it's 70-foot wide, it takes so many dollars to run a foot of sewer, period. Mm-hmm. So if you're developing 70 feet and you can only get one house on it, if you could be able to do something like 38 or 40 feet, you can, over time, you'll get more than one house per lot, which reduces the cost per house per lot. And so it's very expensive to develop ground, raw ground.
What are the prospects for getting this idea through your council?
You know, I think ultimately it's going to happen. Some people in the community they look at it like, well, if you're going to have smaller houses, it's going to decrease my home value. You know, everybody seems to think whatever happens, it's going to impact in a negative vein my residential value of my own house. I think we have to get through that with maybe a project, which, like I said, there's going to be one tomorrow evening, and I hope it does pass, and we'll see what happens. I don't think it's going to reduce existing home values for people.
You know, when an issue like this comes up, is this something that you've just noticed in the community, or are citizens coming to you, Bob, and saying affordable housing needs to be on your agenda?
I guess a general term, an answer for that would be, I certainly get the comment in a nice term, where are our college-educated sons and daughters going to live? And again, depending on what side of this you're on, they can say, well, there are all kinds of existing homes. Fine, but I'd like to see a full choice for people if they want to consider new housing. They're not going to be mansions, obviously. So, yes, people in the community are talking about, we're an expensive city to live in.
Yeah. How about Olathe, Karen Brownlee? To what extent is affordable housing an issue in your community?
We currently have a study we've undergone a study to help us figure out what are the needs when it comes to housing and various prices. And we have those same discussions. Is it a lot size issue or is it something else? But the other thing is we want to be sure that we provide executive housing. So we would like to offer a full variety. Certainly we have our older parts closer to downtown that might be more affordable. And certainly there are a number of apartment projects being mm-hmm. built in Olathe and Johnson County. It seems like some millennials may go that direction. Maybe they go that direction initially, but we want to be sure we have just the right size housing when they want to be homeowners.
So where is Olathe short the most? Is there one category of housing that you're most concerned about?
I hope that study will show us that, because mm-hmm. to me it seems like we have a broad range of housing. We have lovely areas. Then we have areas that are more starter homes. And I know for a number of years, Olathe may have been viewed as a starter home community. And then you go further away from the city, Gardner, Spring Hill, maybe those communities also have that name tag, maybe Olathe less so.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking with two city council members, one from Lee Summit, one from Olathe, about issues in their community, how they relate to what's going on in Kansas City. Bob Johnson, how does crime in Kansas City impact what you guys have to deal with out in Lee Summit? And again, is there a link there that you've noticed?
I'm not sure we have. Certainly we have crime in Lee Summit, although it's not obviously a major issue for us. Our city, entrances to our city are off main highways, and so it really doesn't matter where someone originally lives as they come into Lee Summit potentially to engage in criminal activities. You can get in and out, and they can come from all directions, rural areas, Kansas City, whatever. I don't think Kansas City crime per se has a hugely negative impact.
There's no spillover effect in Lee Summit that you're.
Well, I don't think to the degree that there is a pattern. I don't think we could say that.
How about in Olathe, Karen?
I don't know if there's a spillover, but I just think it becomes kind of a cloud over the Kansas City metro area. Uh-huh. It's something that needs to be addressed. And certainly we do not have the same criminal activity in Olathe that occurs in Kansas City, Missouri. One thing we've done in Olathe is to initiate the niche database system, which is a real-time system that all criminal activity, traffic tickets and reports are put in real time, and a number of municipalities participate in this. And I believe Jackson County does also. Hmm. And I know that Johnson County Sheriff's Office does. I think those collaborative efforts are good for all of us because criminal activity doesn't acknowledge a city limit nor a state line, so that it's very mobile.
Let's turn to some land use issues, Karen. Define that for us so we all know what you're talking about when you talk about land use issues out in Olathe.
Land use, that would be, you know, your zoning and mm-hmm. so forth. Where are you putting each project that's being developed? And I think for me, an important thing is to be sure that when a project is built, that it's built in the best place. So you don't put high-end housing backing up to a highway, for example. You just don't do that. You're going to have problems down the road.
One issue you faced recently involved a Casey's General Store. What was that about?
That's an issue where Casey's has spotted a piece of land that's available right on the edge of a neighborhood. So people who would visit that proposed facility would be exiting right behind homes. So we have to figure out where's the best place. Casey's is an excellent business. We don't want to turn them away, but we need to find the best place so that the traffic counts don't impact the local grade school just down the street, so on and so forth.
Another issue for you when it comes to land use is the Garmin expansion, the big company out there. The concern there is easing traffic around the Garmin campus.
Yes, and I think that a good solution has been found, a partnership between the city and Garmin, to where Garmin will help pay for an additional access point to I-35, which will help move a lot of that traffic.
Mm-hmm.
That's not started yet, but that's something that we're working towards.
Bob Johnson, one big issue in Kansas City, it's been in the news a lot, is the new airport that's being constructed. What do you make of it? What do your constituents think about it? And given that this is a regional amenity, should Lee Summit have had more say in what was going on up there?
The information I've received more than from any source, more than any other in terms of people I talk to in the community, are really members of the construction-related industries. And they certainly have talked to me about what's going on with the new airport. But, you know, Lee Summit's on the southeast corner of the metro area.
It's a long way to KCI.
It really is. And certainly we have people that obviously use the airport. It's probably a 40-mile drive to get there. But it hasn't been. There has been more discussion on what to do with our own Lee Summit Airport and expansion of runways and so forth there than I've heard really with KCI.
I mean, in theory, perhaps, I guess with the cost of the runways, maybe this wasn't really tenable, but building a new terminal might have been an opportunity to have a conversation about where KCI is located.
Well, they certainly haven't talked to us. And like I said, we at Lee Summit will spend more time trying to look at individual plane owners and trying to attract businesses that are not, you know, international businesses,
yeah,
but they're decent-sized businesses. And the executives will fly their own aircraft into regional airports. And that really has more of an impact on us than what's happening 40 miles away.
Well, speaking of long commutes to KCI, anybody in Olathe, Karen, is facing the same thing. Was there a missed opportunity here to involve communities like Lee Summit and Olathe in the KCI construction issue, terminal construction issue?
I know I've sat through a couple other presentations on the option of a new airport so that the conversation occurs. But certainly in Olathe, we don't have any legal authority to impact the decision, and that can be frustrating. And it does impact those who are looking at moving to our area. Now, for those of us who use KCI, we kind of like how easy it is to get out of your car and onto your airplane all within a matter of yards.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're coming in from the outside and you're used to a mega airport that's lovely, that's got retail options, so on and so forth, and I might just add the basic of adequate seating, adequate restaurants, right. so on and so forth, people look at KCI and they think again, is what I've been told.
Right. Bob Johnson, one issue you mentioned to our producer is compensation for your employees. That's been an issue when it comes to police because, if I understand right, Kansas City has been attempting to hire some of your officers in Lee Summit. What's happening there?
We have about half of our work full-time workforce is not organized, and roughly then the other half is, and that would be police, fire, and public works. And we just haven't done much with upgrading salaries over the last two or three years. Certainly the organized groups engage in negotiation. The other 50% that I referenced, we haven't done much. So we just recently put a lot of effort into identifying revenue sources and some of the expenditures we've been making. And it was in December we actually granted a pay raise finally for as we say, our core employees. That takes effect in January this month. Average is about 10% increase, but we haven't done much lately. So
was that in response to what Kansas City was doing when it comes to looking at your
office? No, I just mentioned that as an aside. I think that's interesting. I would hope law enforcement would kind of work with all their law enforcement employees and not try to go after employees of another community. But I was a little irritated that, yes, the police union leader in Kansas City had an open invitation to at least some police officers to come to Kansas City and, you know, you can be employed here. Forgot to tell them they had to live in Kansas City, but that's all right. But yeah, it's fine. I just thought that was a little off the board.
Yeah, how Kansas City pays its employees, how much of a factor does that spill over in Olathe, Karen?
I can't speak directly to a comparison with Kansas City, Missouri, but we have really tried to make sure that our officers are compensated in a manner that reflects their quality. Because we have, I think, an exceptional police department. Our fire department is one of the top 30 in the country. So we try to be sure that we're keeping the people that we train because it costs a great deal to train these quality officers.
Somewhere else where Olathe has made great strides is flooding and dealing with flooding. What have you done there? How does it compare to what Kansas City has done?
Well, I think of 103rd and State Line as an example in the Kansas City, Missouri area that's been neglected and sorely in need of major steps of mitigation. And people are probably familiar with the Coach's Restaurant and the Olathe Water Rescue were the ones that rescued the two individuals from that restaurant. But that's been going on for decades. Why doesn't Kansas City, Missouri mitigate that? Why don't they correct it? In Olathe, there are some funds available that we've been able to tap into, plus our own money. In some cases, they purchased homes and removed the homes, elevated the land, and the homes were rebuilt and sold. I mean, those are huge steps.
I'm just struck, the two of you, having served in Topeka, in your case, Karen Brownlee, in Jefferson City, Bob Johnson, and yet after your service there, serving as a state senator, you came home. You served on the school board. You served now in the city council. Why did you want to do it?
You know, and I mean this when I say this. I think the quality of life anymore is settled at the local level. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's much from Washington or in terms of our state capital that really directly impacts quality of life, like the local cities we live in, the parks that we have, the roads that the internal roads that we have, not the highways running through, but just the lifestyles. That's where the decisions are, and people know that, and they can get to us in a very quick period of time. They most probably know even know where I live and what my phone number is, and it's. This is why people moved, we think, to our communities, because of the quality of our life. And that's pretty much, again, resolved by the local council and mayor.
Yeah. Karen Brownlee, how about you?
I'm a native Olathean, so I really care about Olathe. But having said that, just because I have a long history doesn't mean I need to be short at looking at the future. I really need to be sure that we are looking at where Olathe is going and that we continue, like Bob said, the quality of life and meeting the needs of the citizens. A city government is so much more nimble than the state government. and the opportunities to work with other municipalities to make sure we're all successful occurs much more easily at this level.
To what extent did serving in Topeka help you work in Olathe now?
Well, I had name ID. That helped when it came to
election time.
Getting elected. But there are a number of issues that I worked on the state level. I worked on the E911 level or issue. I, of course, did a lot of economic development, so I get that. So I am taking a different perspective at this point. So there were a number of issues that I worked on the state level that certainly apply on this level.
Bob, how about you? Yeah,
yeah. I wanted to answer that. Thank you for asking. I the economic development issues, you know, over the back, I guess, a total of 23 years off and on in the legislature, much of the economic development incentive programs was done over a lot of those years I was in the legislature. So when I have come back to our city, I'm a little more informed as to what the history is and what it was. And the other thing is, you being in the media, of course, is sunshine open meetings laws. You know, I was there for a lot of those, which most first-time office holders really don't know what open meetings and or sunshine laws are supposed to do, what's an improper meeting, what's not, and so forth. So just a lot of it, I was there for a lot of what we passed. But the economic development is certainly important because a lot of those incentives were developed over the years that I was in the legislature.
Well, that's the voice of Bob Johnson, a Lee Summit City Council member. Karen Brownlee also joined us, and Olathe at-large councilwoman. Thank you both. So good to see you both again.
Thank you. Keep up
the work.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Yeah. Time for our break. When we come back, we'll talk about the rights of the developmentally disabled. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week, we had a conversation on the upcoming Missouri General Assembly session and the issues that await lawmakers at the Capitol. You can hear that and other previous episodes at kcur.org/uptodate. Another week has gone by, and elected officials still can't agree on spending priorities. Tomorrow, how the federal government shutdown is affecting Americans. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, there's some new thinking out there when it comes to the rights of the developmentally disabled. And that thinking is that these folks should be allowed to make life decisions or have some input into those decisions. This is an alternative to the traditional model of guardianship. And here to talk about it is Professor Carrie Shogren. She's a professor in the Department of Special Education at the University of Kansas and director of the Kansas University Center on Developmental Disabilities. She's one of the authors of a new book, Supported Decision Making. She joins us now from the studios of Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence. Professor, nice to have you. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Where's this new thinking coming from?
Well, really the idea of supported decision making and involving people with disabilities in decisions about their life, it's really something that's been growing in the disability field for a long time, emerging from the voices of people with disabilities themselves, who argued, they had a slogan that was "nothing about us without us," that was really used to describe the need to make changes as a society and in how we support people with disabilities to be actively involved in all of these areas.
Then maybe the question is, why has it taken so long to get to this point, Carrie?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I wish one that we had an easy answer to, because then we could make more rapid change. You know, I think pieces of it relate to some of the things that we tackle in this book, changing expectations, really understanding that people with disabilities have a fundamental right to be involved in decisions about their lives. But it's also about changing and providing alternatives within the existing systems, within, as you mentioned, guardianship laws and other practices to really create those opportunities for the involvement of people with disabilities.
Who's been leading the charge here for this change?
Well, I really think that it has been people with disabilities that are leading the charge. I consider myself as an academic, and along with my colleagues that are involved in this work, we're really hearing from people with disabilities themselves that they want the supports that they need to be engaged in their lives, to learn how to make effective decisions, to have access to people to help them implement those decisions. So it's really a privilege for us to be trying to develop those strategies that meet the needs that people with disabilities themselves have identified.
I want to get our listeners involved here. Do you have a family member who could benefit from supported decision-making, or do you think it could make life more difficult for them and for you? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. You know, when we talk about supported decision-making, what are we talking about? What does that involve exactly?
Yes, supported decision making really can be both a formal process, meaning there are states and countries around the world that are developing legal recognitions of supported decision making arrangements. But it's also an informal process. Supported decision making at its heart is all about how you build up the systems of support, the people, the resources that surround a person with disabilities to really enable them to identify decisions that need to be made and to take the steps that they need to make those decisions. So it's both formal and informal in how we really enable decision making.
Is there a controversy attached to this? For instance, if a family member of someone who's developmentally disabled doesn't want to go along with this, talk to me about that.
Well, and ultimately, supported decision making really does emerge from the person, from the supporters that are around them. When we really think about how to enable supported decision making, we want to try to understand the skills and the opportunities that people with disabilities bring to the table for decision making. We want to assess the environmental demands for decision making that the person's going to encounter and make sure that the right supports are in place. And those supports may look very different. Supported decision making is simply an alternative that provides a means to really think through how to engage people with disabilities in that process. How to, for example, think about if a person has to make a medical decision, how we might break down that information in a way that was accessible to a person and that they had the right supports, being perhaps their family members, their friends, other people around them that can enable them to understand some of the elements of that decision.
And what happens when a family member disagrees with what might be happening?
Well, I think that we have to think about how this relates to how all of us make decisions in our lives. And really, supported decision making is rooted in an understanding that people with disabilities have the right, as do all people, to make choices and decisions about their lives. There may not always be agreement amongst everyone about those choices and decisions, but it's by gathering information, by having conversations, by having those opportunities that people build those decision-making skills. So really the focus of supported decision-making arrangements is to create a context where those conversations and those activities can happen for a person, rather than models that have existed in the past that have simply taken those opportunities away.
We're talking about the rights of the developmentally disabled here this morning and this concept of supported decision making. Again, our phone number, 816-235-2888. Let's go to some phone calls here. Tom from Adrian, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Quick question. I have a disabled daughter that's in a group home, and she would not be able to do this, but I'm just curious what the criteria would be or how would the decision-making be done for assigning the rights and the abilities over to some of these folks.
I think supported decision-making, Professor Shogren's new book, deals a lot with what you just asked, Tom. Carrie, tell us about some of the criteria here.
Yes, and we definitely do try to get into some of the nuances of this in the book, because much of this is going to be based on the individual, based on their needs, based on the supports. And we would also argue and really think about the fact that we believe that all people, including people with disabilities with very significant support needs, can be involved to some degree in the decisions about their lives. They may need more intensive supports to be a part of that, but they can communicate their wishes and have those be something that is shared with the team that they're working with and with others. In some of the arrangements, for example, there are a couple of states, the state of Texas, the state of Alaska, that do have formal recognition of supported decision making. And essentially what this means is that people with disabilities with their supporters designate the people that they want to support them in life decisions, whether that be related to medical, financial, where you live, how you do that. So those people are still a part of that decision-making process, but the person with a disability signs off on those individuals, has the right to think about making changes when that's appropriate, given changes in their lifespan. So this model really attempts to make sure that we're understanding the person and what the person needs, rather than using a model like plenary guardianship that is tended to be the same model for everyone that's going under that arrangement.
Tom, respond to that if you would, and how your daughter might be able to communicate some of her wishes.
Well, the problem with my daughter is that developmentally, even though she's 47 years old, she's about a five-year-old mentally, and she makes all of her decisions strictly on the emotions of the moment. So allowing her to have a sign-off on whether her mother or I are going to be representing her or somebody else, if she's mad at us that day, she won't sign off. And I've known a lot of disabled folks, because she's been in group homes for a long time because she's also paralyzed. And some of them would be wonderful at doing this. I think they don't even need a guardian other than for a pro forma purpose, but a lot of them run strictly on emotion. So how do you deal with that problem?
Yeah, interesting point. I'm glad you made it, Tom. Carrie?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. It is a very good question. And I think that you're absolutely right, that we really have to think about how people respond to the opportunities that are presented to them and how we might think about that as a part of a process. When we think about using supported decision-making arrangements, what we would do with your daughter or with someone else that had those types of needs is really thinking about better understanding these things that you're describing about her, how she tends to make decisions, what factors influence her decision-making, the opportunities that she's had to make decisions or not make decisions. And then we'd really use an understanding of those factors to work to identify some supports that might be needed to further enhance the decision-making process. For example, we've developed interventions that might teach certain skills related to decision making and how to think through consequences of actions and engage in more of those conversations. So for some individuals, it may be simply working to continue to build and grow and develop, as we all grow and develop over the lifespan, some of those abilities to be involved in those decisions.
Is it possible that some folks are simply beyond reach, Carrie?
I don't think so. I think that key to working in this field is having high expectations and assuming that there is going to be growth and development. Some people are always going to need very intensive supports from their family members, from the people that care about them, and may often have those people be very, very engaged in the decision-making process. But I think that for all individuals, we're going to be able to identify different ways to enhance the way that they communicate their interests, their goals in this situation, the way that we communicate with them, the way that they might better understand the consequences or the outcomes they're going to experience from a decision.
So even for our caller, Tom's daughter, who's 47, he said, you think there's still a path forward?
I think there's definitely a path forward, and I think that should be, though, a very individualized process based on his daughter, what her goals as well as the family's goals for the future are.
You know, currently there's something called plenary guardianship that has been the common practice for decision making involving disabled. Explain what that kind of guardianship is. I don't understand what that is.
Yes. And I should note that I'm not a lawyer. We did have lawyers, two of my co-authors on the text, that go into more details related to these areas. But really, plenary guardianship, a decision is made that a person goes under plenary guardianship when it's really determined by a court system that they can't direct their own lives or make decisions about their lives. And so guardianship tends to then be something that the person has throughout the rest of their lives and doesn't really enable them necessarily to be involved in some of those decisions if they choose to. And I think one of the concerns and one of the issues that's brought up this issue of supported decision making, because while in many circumstances people may be under a guardianship arrangement and have very supportive family, very supportive friends that continue to involve them in their lives, there's very rarely been actual examinations of the degree to which people with disabilities actually need or continue to benefit from these plenary guardianship arrangements, or if there are areas that they could be involved in. So really, supported decision making is all about finding ways to allow flexibility, to allow growth and development over time that do engage the person.
And again, the amount of decision making authority that we're talking about here ranges from complete and total autonomy all the way down to something that's barely above someone's well-being being dictated, I gather.
Yes, and there definitely is a range. And it's one of the things that we typically talk about in the disability field, that what we want to be doing is providing alternatives so that people can engage and receive the supports that they need based on their disability.
Again, the rights of the developmentally disabled is our topic. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Do legislatures engage here to grant this authority? How involved are the courts? I imagine there's a lot of involvement on behalf of both.
Well, and as I mentioned, I really want to emphasize, too, that supported decision making can both be framed and understood from a legal perspective in terms of courts and laws recognizing this as an alternative to, as you mentioned, plenary guardianship or other arrangements. Supported decision making can also be an informal process that's embedded in the supports in the way that we're engaging with people with disabilities across their lifespan. But when thinking about identifying supported decision making as an alternative to guardianship, it is an issue of really taking a careful look at what is currently in state and local statutes related to how to make sure that people with disabilities have the supports that they need to make decisions, right, but can be maximally involved in that process. And guardianship as a model has been around for a very long period of time. It's not been significantly modified. And so as we've come to better understand people with disabilities and how we can effectively support them, this seems an opportune time to be thinking about, are there differences and changes that we can make here?
You know, maybe this is a good time to put a human face on this issue. Can you describe, Carrie, you know, someone who's benefited from this new authority over their lives and what kind of difference it made to them?
Yeah, and we highlight some stories in the text as well. And I could share a little bit about a woman that was one of the people that originally brought a lot of attention to supported decision making here in the United States. There was a young woman named Jenny Hatch, who one of my co-authors, Jonathan Martinez, was actually involved in some of her work. And Jenny has now shared about her experiences. But Jenny was actually a young woman who was her own guardian, who was living in the community with supports from friends and family, a very informal supported decision-making approach. Jenny, unfortunately, was struck by a car while she was riding her bicycle to work, an accident through no fault of her own, which then led to a petition for guardianship. And Jenny, however, this guardianship led to some changes in her life, another person making decisions about where she lived, where she worked. And Jenny really wanted to retain the ability to have input in those decisions. As she said at one point in time, I don't need a guardian, I just need help and support. And so Jenny was able to make arrangements so that her guardianship became more of a limited guardianship related to her health and well-being while she was dealing with medical issues. And then it transitioned to her becoming her own guardian and receiving supports from those people that she was choosing around her. And one of the reasons that her case and her kind of push got attention was right. that it highlights one of the issues that can emerge when the person with the disability doesn't have the chance to communicate about where they want to be living and what they want to be doing. Mm-hmm. We have to balance that with the realities of what's available in the environments and what's possible. But Jenny wanted to have a voice in that process. And that's what people with disabilities are generally asking for as part of this, to enable us to figure out models to retain that voice, not to be independent or without the support of others in making decisions, but to retain a voice in that process.
And the benefits of that, that you've noticed throughout your own work, Carrie, are what?
Yeah, you know, a lot of my work, in addition to kind of this emerging area of supported decision making, has focused a lot on looking at the benefits of people with disabilities learning how to and having opportunities to make decisions, to set goals for themselves. And we've very consistently found that when people have these opportunities in their lives, they report better quality of life. They actually report better outcomes related to employment, related to engaging in their communities and being a part of the things that they want to. So having these skills and these opportunities can really have a lot of cascading benefits to let people with disabilities be a part of their communities, not separate from it.
I'm struck that the United Nations, I mean, no less than an authority than the UN, has engaged on this issue. What has that body done?
Yes, so the United Nations issued the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities in 2006, which has been ratified by 160-plus countries around the world, although not the United States. But the CRPD, as we call it, the Convention of the Rights of People with Disabilities, really talks about all areas related to promoting the rights of people with disabilities. And Article 12 specifically targets that people with disabilities have the right to enjoy legal capacity on an equal basis with others, and goes on to discuss how we need to, as a world, as a society, figure out ways to really enable people with disabilities to maintain their legal decision-making rights while also receiving the supports that they need to still enjoy those quality of life outcomes that they want.
That's Professor Carrie Shogren, a professor in the Department of Special Ed at the University of Kansas. Her new book, Supported Decision Making. Carrie, thanks for the update. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on the show, our ethics professors are back to offer their picks of the leading ethical issues of 2018, including free and civil speech, as well as access to health care. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR. Up to date, follow me at Steve Kraske. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Devin Davis. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.